As I understand it, in the Theravada Buddhist view, it is not karmically demeritorious to eat meat as long as you don't kill the source. However, it is somehow karmically meritorious to be a vegetarian. If you don't, even if you don't earn good karma points per se, it is beneficial for Dharma practice. Is it beneficial for Dharma practice to be vegetarian, especially while on retreat? E.g., do you positively cultivate compassion by refraining from creating demand for meat, indirectly causing animals to be killed? Yes, so now this is a vegetarian retreat here. Has it been so far? It wasn't. Yeah, especially vegetarian food. Yeah, so you get vegetarian food over here. So we try our very best. You can't be perfect in life, and that's one of the most difficulties. So we try to do your best. And you can't force other people. So it's up to you to make your individual decisions, whatever you can do. I'm a humanitarian. So that means I eat humans. It's an old joke, but anyway. Well, vegetarians eat vegetables. Humanitarian must eat humans. Anyway, I sometimes have the uncontrollable urge. This is an interesting question. Uncontrollable urges. To break out into hip-hop dance moves while doing walking meditation. This is to do a manifesting and does display the seven pieces. Now they say that if it's to make bad karma or to break a piece, it has to be intentional. So if it is the uncontrollable urge, then it doesn't matter. Can we get the video out? Because they'd love to see that happening. I wonder who it is. Yeah, just go for it. See what happens. No, there's nothing wrong with that, but thank you for the silly question. But I heard that monastics have a rule that not to angeli lay people. Is this true? If so, that doesn't seem Buddhist. It seems arrogant and like a caste system. I don't think Buddha would make such a rule. Please comment. Nibbana is the quashing of pride. Seeking royal treatment is making ego. It was actually paying respect to a person was just like in the army. So, you know, you salute sort of the senior officers or whatever it is. So it's not ego, it's just the way that things were done in like in the army. And if you just say, okay, in the army we shouldn't do this, and so you refuse to salute to the commanding officer, you get in big trouble. So it's just the tradition in the time. However, that these days that the Anjali system is quite a nice system. Instead of shaking people's hands, which is, now you don't know what you get on your hand after you've shaken somebody. So an Anjali is a very nice way of doing things. So it's very difficult being a monk. Because, you know, that some people want you to be very, very traditional. And some people want you to be loose. And so you get hit both ways. You know, if you do something, they say, why did you put Anjali to a lay person? You shouldn't have done that. That was the wrong thing to do. You were a bad monk. And then, so if you don't do it, he said, that's being proud, that's being arrogant. You know, you should just treat everybody equal. You're a bad monk. So, you know, either way, you don't win. So that sometimes you do that. If it's something which is worthy of respect. Now, I love putting my hands up. But, you know, you're not just doing it because you're a lay person. But if you do something really, really beautiful and wonderful, you know, you go and sit there for 3 or 4 hours, and after you come, a big smile on your face, I'll put my hands up to you. But, you know, you just, that's why I like respecting someone which is really worthy of respect. You know, sometimes that, I can't really help myself. It's like a funeral service. There's somebody I really respect who's dying. I don't care if they're a lay person or whatever. I'd usually just give them a quick sort of respect. So anything which I think which is worthy of respect, we do that. So, yeah, it is a rule, but it's not a really big rule. That's why that in the monastic system, sometimes that, some monks, they keep all the small rules very strictly, and all the big rules they just ignore. Which is, you know, something wrong over there. So, you know, the small rules, you can bend them a little bit, but the big rules, you know, the major rules, things like renunciation, living a simple life, and not having lots and lots of possessions. You know, those are the sorts of things which are the really big rules. So it's true that I don't like monks living like royalty. And, you know, I deliberately don't do that myself. I think I did say that if you really want a shower tomorrow, you can go over to a monastery. Just over the road. You can get in your car and drive there if you're too lazy. You can walk over there and just get a shower there. But if while you're there, you can actually just check out where I live, in my cave. So anyone who wants to go, because that cave is empty right now, because I'm over here, you can go and see my cave and see how I live. So you actually see that, you know, as a monk, I just sleep in a small cave with just a small mat and just a crock, I think a glass and some water and a crock. That's right, that's all I have there. So you try and keep very simple. So that's, you know, the caste system is not part of Buddhism, and it can be arrogant, but it's not just Anjali, it's just the way you behave is what makes you arrogant or not arrogant. Is there any comments on those questions so far? Any feedback? Yeah. Oh, any time. No, I'm not there at all, because I'm over here at this retreat. So, or maybe I might be over there maybe about 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock to afternoon. Other than that, if you want to find out where it is, just ask one of the monks or ask somebody. Daniel knows where it is. A few people know where it is. But you've got to be careful there, because there's actually 3 bats in there, in my cave. So see if you can find the bats. No one tell her what I mean by the bats. See if you can find the bats. Could you please explain what experience the body of the breath internally and externally means? Okay, this is part of the Anapanasati Sutta. And this is the third, Sabbakaya Patisangvedi, which is the body of the breath. This is the word kaya in Pali. It's almost exactly the same as the word body in English. It doesn't just mean a physical body, it means a group of things. Such as in English we have a body of evidence. And that's nothing to do with no human corpses or anything. Mm-hmm. Now, at the end of a serial killer's escapade, a body of evidence is just, you know, just documents. It's just a group of things. And that's exactly the way this word kaya is used in Pali. It's a body of things, a group of things. So that means a group of all these phenomena, all these sensations, all these experiences called the breath. So what it means in practice is that when you're watching the breath, you watch the breath from the very beginning of an in-breath. You can see it when it just starts. And you can see all the sensations of one in-breath as it grows to its peak and then starts to fade away again. And the last sensation of the in-breath finishing. And then you experience a pause between the breaths. And then you see the first part of the out-breath appearing and see all the sensations as they grow to their peak and then fade away again. So it's the whole of this whole phenomenon, this whole experience, this whole thing we call the breath. So that's what's happening. Instead of saying in, out, in, out, in, out, you see the whole of the breath. Your mindfulness has got deeper, you see more, and actually you're just filling your whole mind with the breath and nothing else. So that's what it means, the whole of the breath. You have to be very careful, because sometimes these teachings here, it's great to actually have learnt Pali and discussed Pali, so you know exactly what you're talking about, but learn as a Westerner does, because we always challenge. So we don't just agree with what our teacher says, we have a look for ourselves. And we discuss and take it much further. And I'm very happy that I taught Ajahn Bambali his Pali, and now he knows it much better than I do. And he tells me when I'm wrong as well. So it's great to have, you know, somebody who will tell you you're wrong. And he's usually right. But this is actually pretty good. That's what the body of the breath really means. It's not really body, it's just the aggregate of sensations called the breath. It's like a body of soldiers, and what else is body of water, yeah. So they use this word body in the same way as they use this word kaya. Because the English language actually is, it comes from Sanskrit, it's an Indian-Aryan language. So there's all sorts of really interesting things when you find out about it. You know where the word yob comes from? Because that's the word youth. You know, it's the word yobana, is the Pali for a young person. A yobana. In other words, a yob, as they say. You know the word luck, where lucky comes from? Because Lakshmi, or Lakshmi in sort of Sanskrit, that's the goddess of good fortune. So that's a Sanskrit god of good fortune. It comes up as lucky in our language. So all sorts of interesting stuff which you find out. That's where the word body. Is that okay? Okay, now this is, you're coming here from using this as a satipatthana. So you're confusing anapanasati and satipatthana here. The internal is literally adhyatang. Adhyatang means inside yourself. And the externally, bahida, means outside of this, means everybody else's breath. So there you're just understanding that your breath and everybody else's breath are all the same. There's nothing special about you. You know, you're just a being just like every other being. No matter sort of what status you are in life, whether you're the king, the president, or just the street sweeper, or whatever you are, it's just breath, that's all. So that's what we do with all the other parts of our body, to realize it's just a body, that's all. There's nothing sort of superior or inferior. So the internal, external, that's just me and you. My body and your body. And of course, I don't know your breath, but you can infer, because I see you breathing, I see me breathing, and I think it's pretty much a good assumption that my breath is pretty much similar to your breath. Dear Ajahn Brahm, what do I do with the song stuck in my head? It seems the more I focus on it, it reinforces its persistence. So dislodge it, bang it out, until it falls out of the air. If that doesn't work, if you really got a song stuck in your head, a guaranteed method that it will get unstuck from your head, stand up now and sing it. You will be so embarrassed that it will soon get out of your head straight away. So yeah, you get a song stuck in your head. That's the problem with songs, because they are designed to get stuck in your head. You know, they've got these little hooks on them, and once you start listening to them, you can't get it out. So the best way of doing it is doing some substitution. So put another song in, but not a nice song. You know, the Yo So Bhagawa Alahang Sam. You know, do the chanting, because that, you know, takes the delightful song out and puts a less delightful song in. So then you're just making that stepping stone, and then it's very easy to let go of the chanting. So try chanting. That would usually work. So this is a substitution. Now, but what's really interesting here, the more you focus on it, the more it reinforces its persistence. Now, that's something really important, because when you try and get rid of things, they become stronger. You're feeding them. So whatever happens on this retreat, whatever problem, whatever difficulty, if you try and get rid of it, if you say, get out of here, you say, I don't want this, I want to get rid of this, you will be in big problem, because it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. So the other way, if you really want to use this and learn a lot about the nature of the mind, is let it be. Make peace with it. Be kind, be gentle with it. Don't indulge in it, but don't try and get rid of it either. Have this beautiful equanimity towards it. Yeah, you can be here as long as you like. I'm not going to sort of, you know, enjoy you. I'm not going to get upset at you. And then you find you won't feed it anymore. You're starving it of the gas, the petrol, the fuel of desire, and ill will. And then it just vanishes away. It's a brilliant thing to do that, because there you learn some very important things about how to deal with defilements, hindrances, and all sorts of other obstacles which come in the meditation. You feed them by trying to control them. You let them go, leave them alone, just watch, don't fight, just investigate, and they disappear. That's the way it's done. Fight it, it gets worse. Indulge in it, it gets worse. Find that middle way. Just being here, just watching. Ajahn, how do we meditate on showerlessness? Yes. How you meditate on showerlessness is you just sit there and you just see this body is just gets very, very hot. And the reason it gets hot is because your metabolism is very high. So get very, very cool. And number two, so you get very, very cool, move very slowly on this retreat. Because the faster you move, the more your metabolism goes up, the more you sweat, and the more you stink. So, in order to lessen the smells, move very slowly and very evenly. And then you lower your metabolism and you also become very, very mindful as well. So go slowly and you sweat less. Number two, the Buddha says that people who are virtuous and kind, who have pure thoughts, also have a pure fragrance come out of them. So have pure thoughts. Because if you have nasty thoughts or lustful thoughts, then you will smell more and we'll all find out about it. So have fragrant thoughts. Thoughts of peace and kindness and generosity and love and enlightenment and freedom and helping all beings. And have thoughts like that and you become fragrant. You won't need to shower. What else can I make up as I'm going along? And I think that should be good enough. Dear Bhante, what is the difference relationship between mindfulness and samadhi? Is it simply a matter of degree, or are they different factors and have different functions? Is samadhi attending to one perception, jhanas, while mindfulness attends to change of perceptions, insight? Thank you. Okay, now remember, samadhi means stillness. And mindfulness means awareness. So those two have to come together, to be still and to be aware. Now the thing which about mindfulness, there's all sorts of different levels of mindfulness. You know that you're mindful now, you're aware, but not of much. But as the meditation retreat grows and develops, your mindfulness increases. You can feel more, you can see more. And a strange thing happens. If you think the food is delicious already, it gets even more delicious the more deep in meditation one goes. Simply because the mindfulness increases. I like telling the story, my first meditation retreat, which I did, was when I was 19. How long? That's about 41 years ago now. And it was at Cambridge. A group of us students, we hired 3 boarding houses during the vacation for 1 week, or for 9 days, to do a meditation retreat. And I was enjoying my meditation, and I was looking forward to the retreat. But there was one thing which I was dreading, and that was the food. Because this was England in 1970, I think it was. And those of you who know the English know that not only do they only shower once a week, but they do more than that these days. But the food was disgusting. I grew up on what was meat and 2 veg. It doesn't matter what meat it was, what vegetables it was, they all tasted the same. Because it was boiled and boiled and boiled and boiled until there was no flavour left. Now that's just an ordinary sort of English food. Now this was a boarding house for poor students. So this would be, of all the cooks and chefs in the whole country, this would be the bottom of the pile. The lowest of the low, the worst of the worst. And of course, now some of my friends would be in those boarding houses and they'd complain so much about boarding house food. And I was going to have to face 9 days of this. And I really thought of, you know, bringing some sandwiches along or something. But to my surprise, in that retreat, that food was delicious. I really ate a lot and enjoyed it. At the time, I thought I was just, you know, good karma, good fortune. I managed to get the only boarding house cook in the whole country who could cook something. But Later on, when I understood about mindfulness, I realized it was nothing to do with the cook and everything to do with my mindfulness increasing in power. Because I had some very good meditation on that retreat, so my mindfulness got so strong, that the last little piece of taste, after all that boiling and steaming, the last little piece of taste left, I could pick up. I was that sensitive, I could find it. And that's why it was delicious. And the same way here, when your mindfulness gets really strong, the food here gets incredibly tasty and delicious. Much more so than at home. And the reason is because your mindfulness is increasing in power and strength, you pick up more flavours. As similarly I said this morning, walking up the hill, you see more of what's out there. And what you see is fuller in colour, it's richer in texture. So even the food is like that, it becomes more delicious. So that gives you an example of what this mindfulness really is. It's not just being aware, it's empowering it, making it stronger and stronger, till you can really see deeply into things, until you can take some English 1970 or 60s cooking and think, wow, this is delicious. Then it shows you've got some good mindfulness coming along. So that's mindfulness. But where that power comes from, that comes from the stillness of the mind. And that's the link between them. The more still you are, the more powerful the mindfulness is. Basically, the energy of the mind just flows into the mindfulness and it's not lost or wasted doing this, doing that, moving about all the time. You're focusing, containing the energy into mindfulness. It gets incredibly strong and powerful. And that's one of the purposes of meditation. Getting that mindfulness very, very, very strong. So it literally just sees deeper into things, sees much more. And that gives rise to the insights. So those two, you do need actually stillness to get strong mindfulness to get insight. And actually how it works. And you'll experience that. On this retreat, there will be times you just feel so awake, so alert. And it happens on these retreats, there's two or three people, they get so incredibly powerfully mindful, you can't go to sleep at night. You don't want to go to sleep, you're not tired. You've got energy, real nice energy. And you're happy as well. And don't worry, you don't go crazy. You know, you catch up later on sometime. But you know, you don't need to sleep because your mindfulness is powered. Nah, next question. This is a big question on a big sheet of paper. What evidence do I have that reincarnation exists? Look, you wrote this question, so it means you have to be reincarnated from your previous life. You're back again. Where do you think you come from? You can't come from nowhere. So here you are again. And if you don't believe me, I always say, anyone who doesn't believe in reincarnation in this life will certainly believe in reincarnation in your next life. Next question. Nobody has used their cell phone to call me after they die to confirm they're hanging about, waiting to choose a more appropriate copulating couple than their last choice. Okay. Recently, last rains retreat in October. So this is a true story. There was a Sri Lankan lady. She'd been listening to my talks a lot. I think she's been over here. And she called me. An emergency during the retreat time, not really supposed to receive many calls. So can you please help my brother? He's got a very, very bad blood cancer. We sent him to Singapore for treatment, but nothing is working. He's now paralyzed. He's only got a few days to live. Can you please talk to him? So of course, you know, you sort of don't worry about retreats and stuff. Of course you help out. So for two evenings in a row, I talked to him on the phone, and he was so weak. You know, when he spoke to me, he spoke very slowly, and you could have to listen very, very carefully to listen to what he was saying. You know, but I gave him some advice about dying and about letting go, and then the third night he died. So I caught him just in time, which is wonderful. And no, he was paralyzed, so you know, he could only just about speak. The next evening, his sister called me to tell me that he died the night before. But also to Tobin, he said, you won't believe this, Ajahn Brahm, it's absolutely true, that this morning I got an email from him just saying thank you. And the email was sent about 6-8 hours after he died. The email, it's true, email from beyond the grave. So actually you're wrong here, that people actually do. They don't get cell phones, and that's passé. That's so sort of 20th century. This is 21st century. Send emails. Twitters. Have you checked your Twitter account yet to see if there's anything? So now I told people, now I know what Gmail means. Ghost mail. That was a joke at that time, but that's only the joke part of it, but that's a true story. Now, there's no way, they checked out, there's no way he could have pre-programmed that, because he'd been paralyzed for days before he died. So they got an email from him, certainly after he died, just saying the word thank you. So there you go, whoever wrote this, yeah, check your cell phone, check your email. And there are many people who have their stories about reincarnation. And you can read about them. The best book to read is Professor Ian Stevenson's book. Now, he did such excellent work about people who could remember their past lives. And there's many, many people. But on this retreat, if you really get into some deep meditation, this is one of the things I usually teach later on, to confirm for your very self that you've lived before. What you do, you have to get some really nice meditation. So you're sitting here in a couple of hours, really blissed out, having a lot of energy, a lot of mindfulness. When you come out of the meditation, before you uncross your legs and go and have a cup of tea or something, just make the mental suggestion, just once, very simply, what is my earliest memory? Just say that. If you've got enough stillness and power, almost immediately something will come up which you will recognize as a very early memory, usually from your early childhood when you were a baby. It won't be like a memory like you remember what you were doing yesterday. It will be a re-experiencing of that time. You're back there. Your eyes closed, being able to see, hear, and even ask questions about what's going on around you. That's actually how it happens. Then you say, earlier, please. And keep pushing it back until you get in to an experience of your previous life. And again, this is a re-experiencing of it. Clear. So it's not one of these memories, where did I put my glasses? I'm sure I put them somewhere. No, this is actually clear and very, very convincing. And actually, that's how it works. And many people in these retreats have done that. And it blows their mind. Yeah, actually, they do remember their past lives, just like it says in the old books. You do need very powerful meditation, but you don't need... Some people seem to do it without the jhanas, but pretty close onto the jhanas. So you get very powerful meditation, very peaceful. And you just ask, remember to ask that question, what's my earliest memory? You can't force it. It comes up straight away. It doesn't come up at all. And then that will convince you once and for all. You can read books. You can be people you trust. All that does is sort of convince you, oh, that's interesting. That might be the case. But if you remember it yourself, then there's no doubt anymore. And of course, that will change your whole life. Simply because you realize, and this is absolutely true, there is reincarnation, there is a rebirth. This is not your only life. Now imagine how that would change the way you look at life. Death is just, another, here we go again. Been there, done that. And just the whole attachment business. If it's just one life, this one life is really, really important. But it's one amongst thousands. It's not so important. You become far more equanimous to the ups and downs of life. Far wiser. You see the big picture. So check that out during this retreat. And don't do it this evening or the next day. It's too early. When you really get some good meditation going, at the end, just ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? and see what comes up. Any questions about that? Yeah. Yeah, okay, that's a very good question. Thank you for that, because I should have said that if you do get a past life experience, the closest experience of your past life to this life is your death moment. And that's just so strong that sometimes people who have tried this, you know, they've gone to the babyhood, or sometimes they've got in their mum's womb, and the next thing they got, they don't like at all. Because, you know, it's not just remembering, it's re-experience. Re-experiencing, you know, the very unpleasant feeling of dying. And they've come out and they've told me, I don't want to ever do that again. And so, because of that, I tell people nowadays, if you do that technique, what's my earliest memory, you do come across an unpleasant, quickly say, earlier, please. That's all you need to do. And you just go back earlier, before that death moment. So you actually can experience yourself in your previous life, some other sort of powerful moment of that life. Can be a happy moment, but you don't experience that death moment, which is usually very uncomfortable. So you can actually get in. It's really interesting. Answers a lot of questions, you know, about who you are, why you are, why you're hanging out with the people you do. Please enhance our knowledge about walking meditation, or also a bit more about keeping the mind still. Would you have to focus your mind on a particular thing, or how does that really work? Okay, I do the walking meditation, more about keeping the mind still. You've got many, many talks in the morning, so tomorrow morning I'll do more about keeping the mind still. But for walking meditation, you can use one of these halls here, you can do it in your room, you can walk on the anywhere in this property. The point is, you usually start, you know, in one end of the room, then you walk to the other end, you walk back again. The first thing you understand is you don't get anywhere. Brilliant. Marvellous. Because too many things you do in life is to get somewhere. To get something out of it. To achieve something. A walk in meditation, you end up where you start. Just like life. You know that story about those two guys on the... Old guys, they're talking to each other in the park. And one says, oh, it's 80 years of age today, I feel terrible. So many aches and pains, it's awful being 80. What about you? You know, you were 80 last month. And his friend said, I feel great. I feel like a newborn baby. You know this one. How come you feel like a newborn baby when you're 80? Well, look at me. I've got no hair, I've got no teeth, and I've just wet my pants. So it's true in life, we just go back again to where we started off with nappies and soft food. So that's what happens. So yeah, it all goes round in circles. So walking meditation. You get a nice path, nice and simple. Put your gaze 2 meters in front, not to the left, not to the right, not up, not down. 2 meters in front. No, you don't have to get a tape measure, just roughly. Just so that you can see where you're walking and you're not going to bump into something or step on something. So you're just 2 meters in front, then you start walking. Naturally. You all know how to walk, don't you? So I don't have to teach you that part of walking meditation. Walk naturally and just, number one, be in the present moment. Just here, just right now. So don't think about where you've come from. Don't think about the cup of tea you're going to have afterwards. Don't think of anything except where you are. Present moment awareness. Number two, keep silent. Don't have a commentary, writing your book, your fantasy, thinking about what you're going to do later on. Stop that fantasy, that commentary, and just be here quietly. And then, instead of watching your breath, just feel the feet, the sensations in the feet. Which foot is moving first? What part of the foot is moving? Is it the left or the right? You're not looking at those feet, you're feeling them. So you're becoming aware of the sensations in the feet as they're moving. And that's what you're focusing on. The feet sensations. And just walk at a natural speed. And it is not a competition to see who can walk the slowest. So just walk naturally and forget about what other people are doing. What's that joke about the walking meditation? About the fellow who had just finished one of these retreats. And he worked in Perth Zoo. And when he came to work on a Monday morning, he was walking so slowly. And he talked to his boss with perfect mindfulness. So his boss thought, what am I going to do with this guy? So he had the perfect job for him that day until he sort of wound up and got back to normal again. He put him in charge of the tortoise enclosure. So he said, you look after the tortoises. He said, yeah, I will look after the tortoises. Off you go. So he walked very slowly and mindfully to the tortoise enclosure. And the head keeper decided to check up on him at lunch hour. And he saw the tortoise gate, the gate to the enclosure was open and all the tortoises had escaped. And he said, what happened? The tortoises have gone. And the guy said, yes, I just opened the gate and whoosh. It's a very silly joke, but it's very funny. So that's taking walking meditation over the top. So just do it, and do it for relaxing, calming the mind. How should one respond to reoccurring negative images, thoughts and memories? Welcome them. So don't try and get rid of them. Negative images, thoughts and memories. Look, you could have the material here for a book, for a movie. Because as people love these negative and violent movies, so write it all down. So in other words, if you welcome the negative memories or whatever else is in your mind, if you welcome them, thank you for coming to visit me, then all the negativity just vanishes. You're not feeding it with the dark energy. You're welcoming it and it becomes nice and peaceful and happy. Look, this is one story from my life. Look, many years ago, I think I was in Thailand when this happened, I was meditating nice and peacefully and then got some nice deep meditation and I got this image in my mind. An image right in front of me was this demon, these big bulging eyes, you know, like they're coming out the sockets. And just the teeth were all jagged and dripping blood. It had skulls around its neck. I forget what else, and just really angry eyes. And oh, the mouth, the tongue was coming out. It was going. Is this on the camera, by the way? And it looked very, very frightening. But I had enough wisdom to know that this is just like a creation of the mind. And that's what it is. These negative images, you create them and you can mess around with them. So that's what I decided to do, to mess around with them. So just like I used to do as a naughty school kid, I've blacked out a few of its fangs. So, you know, it had these big holes in its teeth. And instead of these big, scary, bulging eyes, I put a pair of, like, sunglasses, Ray-Bans on. It looked really cool. And on top of its spiky head, I put a straw hat, you know, with a flower coming out. And I messed around like that until this demon was so funny, was so ridiculous, I laughed. I totally humiliated that demon and never came back again. That's how I dealt with the negative things. Have fun with them. Play around with them. And I remember this guy came to monastery once and he came to see me because he was having all these visions of demons coming out from the paving bricks. He was really scared. I thought, you know, should I go and admit myself to hospital? I said, no, don't admit yourself to hospital. I told him what I did. He said, play with these demons. Have fun with them. And so he came and saw me 24 hours later. He said, I had a great day. I made them this way and that way and all over the place. And he said, you know, after a while, they just vanished. They disappeared. That's brilliant. Because it's the fear, the negativity. That is the problem, not the demon. And they're just actually quite cuddly and good fun. So it's your attitude to have towards these things. So if you have some memories, images, thoughts and memories, Don't add negativity towards them. Leave them alone or play with them. Add some fun to them and then they disappear. Try and get rid of them and they stay. Could you give some guidance on thoughts on walking meditation? Done already. So this is not a meditation question. When a young person commits suicide, how can you console the parents who blame themselves? What can you say to them? Okay, a few years ago is a classic story I use. A few years ago, just before the end of the year examinations, a Sri Lankan boy, 17, sort of hung himself, and his young brother found him in the porch and was really, really upset. The whole family sort of were really devastated. They came to see me. And when they left, they were perfectly at peace. I really sort of turned them around. It was really quite impressive. And the story I used was say, look, you know, your son is about to do the end of the school exams, the year 12 exams. So how many subjects does he do? They didn't know where I was going with this, but they said five. How many papers, you know, examinations in each one? He said about two in each. That's about 20, so about 10 papers. How many questions in each paper? Say there's like eight questions in each paper. That's 80 questions he has to answer for his end of year exams. Suppose he really messes up one question and does a stupid answer to one question. Does that mean that he can't go to university? Because the other 79 may be perfect answers. So just one bad answer doesn't mean you fail. I said, that's what your son has just done. He stuffed up one question and committed suicide. What about all the other beautiful questions he's answered in his life? Why is it when someone does something bad, that's all we see? We see the suicide, that last moment of their life, and they did answer the question badly. What about all the rest of the things they've done in life? They've done lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of good things. So just because you failed the last question doesn't mean you can't go to university. When I said that and they got the message, then they were really at peace. And even their son, the guy who found him at the end of the rope, he wasn't talking at all, but he was laughing on the way home. It works. Just change your perception, different ways of looking at things. Because nobody's at fault. I don't know why we keep blaming ourselves. This is life. Dear Ajahn Brahm, this is a letter, not a question. Firstly, thank you for the opportunity to attend this magnificent retreat. Magnificent, you've only just come. Being only a novice meditator, I have many questions. But let me start with walking meditation. Today, I strutted up and down the red mat for about an hour. You see, even here, we look after you so much, we give you red carpets to walk on. Strutted up and down on the red mat for about an hour. It felt like I was taking an unruly animal for a walk. You're not an unruly animal, that's just who you are. Enjoy yourself. My mind wandered to many places and wondered about many things, like when I get to the end of the mat, should I spin and kick off the wall like an Olympic swimmer? Yeah, go for it. Twirl on the spot like a Russian ballerina? Yeah, that's okay. Stop, contemplate the bricks and turn with reverence. What to focus on when walking? Okay, I've mentioned the answer to that. You focus in the present moment, silence, and just on the feelings in your feet. The calories consume aching muscles or the defocused wall, being careful not to crash. What speed to walk? Just natural speed. Slow, deliberate steps, a fast clip to cover more ground and beat my competition. No matter, as long as you get to the other end. Any suggestion to calming the beast? Look, it's not a beast. It's someone very nice. So number one, just look at yourself. Oh, poor thing. If you want to do a ballerina walk, that's fine. You know, if you just want to, you know, just pretend you're a supermodel, you know, demonstrating, you know, your jeans and your t-shirt, whatever. Very good. Next question. Now, this is very important indeed. Dear Ajahn, can we swap minds, please? No way, I'm not having yours. Name your price and advise on date and location of exchange. Check it out on eBay. How do you get your mind to stop its constant chatter? It's like having Alan Jones on and I just can't turn him off. Okay, well, that's a really good question. So that I was going to do this tomorrow, but I can do it this evening. And now, if those of you who haven't heard this exercise, you know, pay attention, because as I'm speaking, I also want you to be aware of your reaction inside your mind. So don't just listen to me, listen to also your reaction. Because as I'm speaking, you will begin to notice that there are some spaces between my words. In those gaps, what was happening inside your head? You had stopped chattering. You were silent. There it was again. The chatter is not constant. It's only you don't notice the spaces between the words. Now I've pointed it out to you, you can go to those spaces anytime you like. Look at the spaces between your thoughts, the gap between the words. Isn't that nice? Now you know what silence is, and it's beautiful. You'll value it, and it will grow on you, and it will squash out Alan Jones and anybody else. I'll say more about that tomorrow, but that gives you a taste. I'm having extreme difficulties falling asleep each night. What's a simple meditation technique that will keep me with this? Much appreciated. Listen to one of my talks. It's amazing how many monks' talks send people to sleep, because we're calm and soft. Okay, difficulties falling asleep each night. Well, stay awake at night and sleep during the daytime. It's amazing just how many people can't actually meditate and can keep straight up because they keep falling asleep. So, get on your bed and meditate, and then you'll fall asleep. Try falling asleep, and then you end up meditating. So use reverse psychology. Don't try to fall asleep. Try to keep awake, and then you'll fall asleep. That's true, isn't it? Because a lot of times, there was one time a few years ago, I was having some difficulty getting asleep. I don't know, it was too much tea or coffee, probably. But every time I decided, yeah, I'm going to fall asleep. I really want to fall asleep. I really have to fall asleep. I'm going to get up early in the tomorrow morning. I've got to give a talk. I've got to do this. If I don't fall asleep, I'm going to be in big trouble. And of course, the anxiety kept you awake. So instead, what I thought, as a monk especially, my bed is the most comfortable place in the whole world. Number one, no one asks me any questions. I'm quiet and you're really comfortable. Are your beds comfortable? Nice and cozy? Great. Why do you want to waste that beautiful experience by going to sleep? So lay down and, oh, this is just so nice. Who wants to go and sleep? This is just so cozy and nice. I just really want to enjoy this. I don't want to go to sleep. I just want to enjoy the comfort and coziness. Then, of course, you go to sleep. So that's what I did. I said, no, I don't want to go to sleep. This is just too cozy and comfortable. And then, of course, the next minute, I knew I was waking up again. So after a good night's sleep. So again, don't try to go to sleep. Just enjoy the comfort. In other words, enjoy the moment and then you relax. I'll give you some more things about that, but there's a few more questions to go before we finish off this evening. After 25 years of meditating, I still see darkness besides the calm feelings while sitting quietly. What is it, Ajahn? Do I still carry on with the approach of stillness? Thank you. Okay. I don't know who this is, but after 25 years of meditating, there must be some of the oldies here. Who is this? Okay. I still see darkness besides the calm feelings. Okay, while sitting quietly. Number one, it must mean that you want something more. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. Which means you're never really fully in the moment. So the answer to this is just be content. You've got some calmness. It's dark, it's beautiful, soft and wonderful. Enjoy it. Be content. Allow it to be. this is good enough for me. Because it must mean you've got some sort of desire and wanting there which stops you going deeper. Remember what I said about the cup being still? It's getting still, but you're not quite letting it go. You're holding it so it won't get fully still. You want something. Just let go of all the wanting. This is good enough for me. I don't want anything else in the whole world. This is good enough for me. Then, with no expectations and no wants, no desires, then it gets very peaceful. The two types of meditation. Who knows what the two types of meditation are? Any suggestions? Now that's an interesting one. That don't answer me because so you always get it wrong. People usually say samatha vipassana. That's the wrong answer. And I mentioned to people when I gave a talk last Friday night, I said, if I ask a question like that, don't put your hand up because I'm just taking you for a ride. It's always a trick question. The two types of meditation are called Second Noble Truth Meditation and Third Noble Truth Meditation in Buddhism. The Second Noble Truth means craving leads to suffering. So that's Second Noble Truth Meditation. You want something, therefore you suffer. So if your meditation isn't working, you're suffering, you're not content, you're not happy, it's not working, you're just really depressed, you're disappointed, you're suffering. Why? Because you've been wanting something, you've been craving, you have been doing Second Noble Truth Meditation. Basic teaching of Buddhism. Third Noble Truth Meditation is the way to go. Third Noble Truth is letting go of craving leads to enlightenment. Peace, happiness, bliss, the whole works. So if you're having a peaceful meditation, things are just so joyful, so nice, well done, you've just done Third Noble Truth Meditation. You have let go of craving. So when you do get peaceful, when you do have a calm, beautiful meditation, whatever it was you were doing, that was letting go. Well done. Now learn exactly what that letting go was. It's no longer a theory, it's an experience. You've done some letting go. You were peaceful. Do it again. Do it more. And then you understand the two types of meditation. So if ever you're suffering, the meditation is disappointing you, it's because you've been doing the wrong type of meditation. You've been wanting something. Craving leads to suffering. So let go. Be content, this is good enough for me. No craving, no wanting. I'm going to just fall asleep. I'm just going to be the most stupid monkey in the whole world. And then you become the most enlightened one. Because you don't want. You take off the arrow of craving. And I'll be doing that again and again and again. In the chant, recollecting the Sangha, what does it mean? What does it refer to? What does it mean by a field of merit? Just like when you plant your rice or your potatoes, if you put it in a rich field, you get lots of potatoes and lots of rice and lots of carrots and lots of everything else. Actually, I know a good joke about carrots. I haven't told this joke for a long time now. It's one of my favorite jokes about the two carrots walking down the street. You remember that one? Okay. You're going to get it again anyway, so I don't care if you've heard it or not. There were two carrots walking down the street together. And then this car, this drunk driver, lost control of his vehicle and slammed into one of the carrots. And he was so badly injured, his mate just got on his mobile straight away and called 000. The ambulance came and the medics looked at him and this is really serious injury, we're going to take him to the hospital. So they put the injured carrot into the back of the ambulance, his friend got in as well. And they sped to the hospital, they put him straight in the emergency room. The triage nurse said, no, it's surgery. So they put him into sort of emergency surgery and his friend was waiting in the waiting room, just frantically, so afraid that his best friend, you know, was, you know, so badly injured. And after 1 hour, the doctor came out and said to the carrot, said, I've got some good news and bad news for you. And the good news is your friend, Mr. Carrot, he's going to make it. He's going to live. The bad news is because of his injuries, he's going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life.
I could never tell that with a straight face. That's a stupid joke. I really love that joke.
A field of merit means, okay, you give sort of, you know, a donation and you get lots back for it. So look, Jhana Grove is a field of merit. Imagine, so you give a donation over here and it means people can meditate, you know, comfortably. Isn't that a beautiful investment, what you really want? And please excuse me, you give it a donation to one of these fancy temples, which, you know, got lots of gold and marble. Yeah, they look good, but, you know, what's the point? It's just another tourist attraction. So where people are really practicing, like the nuns' monastery, that's a field of merit, because there's very few Buddhist nuns. And we've got a place, we're trying to grow them here. You know, like a field, it's like our farm, our nun farm in Kijigana. So that's a field of merit. So that means actually a good place where you can actually get some good bang for your bucks. Your merit bucks. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if reborn into other higher realms, how does one have access to and continue to practice the Dharma? If reborn into lower realms, does one still retain karmic conscious choice, or are you stuck until bad karma exhausted and have to wait until high rebirth to practice Dharma? If you are reborn into higher realms, yes, you can still have access and continue to practice Dharma, because even in the suttas, many people still did very well. They, you know, learnt some. They came down and listened to a good talk, the Devas, and they became enlightened. One of my favourite stories was of this: these two monks. There were two monks and the two good friends, and they came to a nice place. There was this one very devoted woman disciple, and she said, "Please spend the retreat here, you know, next to me. I will look after you. I will cook for you. I'll even wash your robes for you. So you don't have to do anything. Just meditate. Just meditate, because I really want you to become enlightened and do the very, very best. And I'll do everything for you." And that's what they did. And later on, when she died, she was a really, really good person. And she got reborn, I think, in the Tawatingsa realm, a very high heaven realm. And she just was just wondering about what happened to those two monks. And she found that those two monks had been reborn in the heaven realm below her, and she was really upset, and she went down and scolded those monks. "I cooked for you, I cleaned for you all that time. I don't know what you were doing. You're certainly not meditating. Look, even me, I've got to a much higher realm than you have, you two scallywags." And she scolded them. And one of those monks was humble enough to listen to her and realize, yeah, he was sort of he was not really practicing well. And because of that beautiful, humble thought, he actually got reborn in the higher realm. And the other monk, you know, was just so arrogant and proud, he said, "What does she know?" And just stayed where he was. I love that little story, because, you know, it was a case that one of the monks said, because he got a good scolding from a person who used to look after him, that managed to actually to get something and to learn. So, yeah, just even from a scolding, you can make progress in the heavenly realms. Well, you know, sometimes you can get some enlightenment in heaven realms. But in the lower realms, you're stuck until bad karma is exhausted. No. You are stuck there until you forgive yourself. You exhaust your bad karma. The doors of the lower realms, the hell realms, are open, waiting for you to walk out when you're ready to forgive yourself. That's one of the problems. The reason why people get to be reborn in lower realms is because they're consumed with guilt, judgment and punishment. And they decide they've done something wrong, they need to be punished, and they punish themselves. No one sends you to a hell realm, only you do, because you think you deserve it. No one sends you to a lower realm, only you do, because you remember some unskillful things you did in the past and you will not let it go. That's what happens. And you can do that in this realm as well. You've done some terrible things, some bad things which have happened to you, and you keep it and it stops you being happy. It sends you into a lower realm in this life. So to overcome that, goodness gracious, I'm going to have to stop these questions after this one. The other ones I'll do tomorrow, because there's heaps of them left. To overcome that, there is a little, or should I say this, there's no water. That's that toilet paper simile. Now I have to, please, can you remind me tomorrow night about the toilet paper simile? Because it's how to let go of the bad things of the past. But if I did it today, we need lots of water for this, and we haven't got any water, so it won't work tomorrow, and you'll stuff up all the toilet bowls, and I'll be in big trouble. So, yeah, it can be done, and I'll tell you how to do it tomorrow. So, another one. Will you be guiding any of the meditations? If so, will you please advise in advance? I'd hate to be doing another meditation at the time. That's my guided meditation for you. So I've already said that. So sit on your bed, lie down. That's my guided. Now, we only do really a guided meditation at the very end of the retreat, where we do a guided loving kindness meditation. Because most of the time during this retreat, I will be giving you all the instructions so you'll be able to do it by yourself. So there'll be lots and lots of instructions given. And I think, Danny, have you got any of the guided meditations on tape? Yeah, so we've got them on tape. So you can get a tape recorder or an iPod or something from somewhere, and you can get some downloaded from Danny. One CD player. So if you want a guided meditation, go and see Dania. You get it on sort of the iPod or on the CD, and then you can put your headphones on and you'll be guided. Conversation between teacher and student. Students, so how long does it take to get enlightened? Teacher, about 20 years. And what if I try harder than 40 years? That's very good. That's a very good. You've understood. How long does it take to get enlightened? About 20 years. And what if I try harder than 40 years? Very good. I like that one. I'll do a couple of more. What do monks wear under their robes? And the answer is suicide vests. You have to become a monk to find out. There are some questions which only monks can find the answers to. Okay, I'm going to do this later on. Some years ago, there was an Australian man who was on trekking in Ladakh. And as he was trekking in Ladakh, the beautiful mountains of the Himalayas, you know, he was taking photographs and he's being sort of quite negligent, and he got separated from the rest of the party. And because he was separated, you know, he took the wrong turn and got lost. That's very dangerous, being sort of lost at night in the Himalaya mountains. There's bears and all sorts of things there. He was very fortunate, you know, just at twilight, he saw some lights in the distance. Made for the lights, it turned out to be a monastery, a Buddhist monastery. And so, you know, he asked permission to stay the night because it was too late to go anywhere. And the abbot said, sure, no problem. So the abbot gave him a meal as a guest and gave him a nice room, and he stayed the night there. But in the middle of the night, just after midnight, he was woken up, because this was a very ancient monastery, been there for hundreds of years. He was woken up in the middle of the night by the most amazing sound he'd ever heard in his life. Now, he'd heard the Berlin Philharmonic before, and he'd heard just the most amazing virtuosos. And this was music which was just unearthly, and it really thrilled him. And when it finished, he just went off into the deepest of sleeps. And when he woke up in the morning, he got some breakfast from the monks. And he asked, you know, took leave of the abbot. Because the abbot said, we'll give you a monk. You know, we know where this tour group will be. We'll do a shortcut so you can catch up with them. And the man sort of thanked the abbot, but then just asked, sort of, you know, what was that noise last night? Because, you know, I heard in this room this beautiful, incredible noise. I've never heard anything like it before. And the abbot said, oh, that. He said, I'm sorry, I can't tell you. Only monks know the secret of that noise. He said, oh, come on, you can tell me. He said, no, I can't. So, you know, he bit his lip and got out his wallet. Okay, how much? $20, $50, $100. The monk said, no, look, it's nothing to do with money. You know, I can't tell. You have to be a monk to know the answer to that. So, you know, he just argued and argued, but, you know, the abbot, you know, would not be corrupted. So he had to leave. And when he came home to Australia, he couldn't get that sound out of his head. And even at night time, he kept dreaming of it. And he'd get so obsessed with that sound, because it was the most amazing sound he'd ever heard in his life. He went to see a therapist, and even the therapist could not get the obsession out of him. So 12 months later, he was back at that monastery, knocking at the door. And he demanded to see the abbot and said, "Look, you have to tell me what that sound was. It's driving me absolutely crazy." And the abbot said, "Look, I told you last time a year ago. I can't tell you because you're not a monk." He said, "Exactly. Make me a monk. I have to find out." And the abbot said, "It takes 2 years of training before you become a monk. I don't care how long it takes. I'm going out of my mind. I have to find out what that sound was." "Okay," said the abbot. So the abbot started the training for this young Australian man. 2 years later was his ordination day. And as soon as he was ordained as a monk, the first thing he said, "Great, now tell me what that sound was." And the abbot said, "Look, I'll do better than that. I'll show you. Come to my room just before midnight." So he was at the room just, you know, an hour before midnight, because that's the whole reason he was there, to try and find the answer to this incredible supernatural sound he'd heard 3 years ago. And just before midnight, the abbot came in and said to him quite seriously, "Look, this is something supernatural. Not many people have seen this. Are you sure you want to see it?" He said, "Yeah, I have to. It's driving me crazy." "Okay," said the abbot. So he took out a bunch of keys from his desk. And just in the back of the office, there was the curtain. Behind the curtain was actually this really ancient door, wooden door. And he took out the first key and opened the wooden door. And it creaked open. It hadn't been opened for a long time. And just as they opened the door, the sound started up. It was so incredibly beautiful. It just made him cry. You know, there's sometimes you hear something and it just sort of gets right inside of you. It's beautiful. It's inspiring. It's amazing. And he couldn't help but see these tears coming down his cheek. And they walked down this corridor to the source of the sound. There was another door at the end of the corridor. It was an iron door. And the abbot had to get another key out to open the iron door. And when they opened the iron door, you could hear the sound more clearly. They were getting closer, and it's even more thrilling. And he saw at the end of that corridor, there was another door, which was solid silver, encrusted with jewelry. This was something very, very special. And the abbot got out a third key, put it in the lock, but before he turned it, he looked again. "You sure?" He said, "Yes." So he turned the key and opened the door. And now the noise was even more strong and more beautiful and more thrilling. It always make you faint. It was so amazingly wonderful. And he saw there was one more door left at the end of this corridor. And that was a door of solid gold, worth a fortune. And the jewels which were embedded in that door were again just so priceless. And they got to that door. And he knew just on the other side of that door was the answer to the source of this amazing sound. An answer which he'd been driving him crazy for 3 years. And he was about to find out the answer. And the abbot turned to him once again. "Look, this is the last time I'm going to ask you this question. Are you prepared? Are you ready for what you're about to see?" And he realized this was serious business. So he really thought, he said, "Okay, look, I don't care what it is. I'm going crazy trying to find out the answer. I've come this close. Open the door." So the abbot smiled and said, "Okay." And he opened the door and the monk saw it. You know what it was? "I can't tell you. You're not monks." Okay, that's enough for tonight. The other questions I'll answer tomorrow. That's a good monk's joke. Only monks can tell that joke. So that's very, very good. Okay, so three sadhus. Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.